from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
This is War News Radio.
I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This week on War News Radio, Canvas and Casualties, we visit an art exhibit about the war in Afghanistan.
Then we learn about the flood in Pakistan and how climate change can affect power struggles.
Finally, we take a look at the Afghan school project.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraq's President Jalal Talabani was re-elected by Parliament this week. After being re-elected, President Talabani reappointed Nouri al-Maliki as Iraq's prime minister. Al-Maliki's appointment ended an 8-month-long political deadlock following inconclusive elections in March. He now has 30 days to select cabinet members for the government. Prior to President Talabani's election, about a third of the members of the Iraqiya coalition walked out of Parliament, protesting that a motion to end the stigma of Ba'athism was not passed. Four of Iraqiya's key members were previously blocked from political office due to their connections to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that Washington was open to keeping U.S. troops in Iraq beyond the current 2011 deadline, if Iraq asks. Both U.S. and Iraqi officials have expressed more willingness to reconsider the deal in response to the recent increase in violence. However, Gates also said that any request to have these talks would need to come from a functioning Iraqi government, which after 8 months of political deadlock between the Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish blocs, still does not exist.
Senior British military officers could face a war crimes trial pending an investigation of the alleged torture of over 220 Iraqi civilians at British-run detention facilities. Allegations of abuse, which occurred between March 2003 and December 2008, include sleep deprivation, sexual abuse, death threats, and solitary confinement. Phil Shiner of Public Interest Lawyers is representing many of the Iraqi men. He says his clients are entitled to a large-scale public investigation of the UK's detention policy. A team set up by Britain's Ministry of Defence denies the need for public investigation as it is currently leading a 2-year investigation into the allegations.
Also this week, the US Army convened a hearing for Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs to determine whether he will face a court-martial. Gibbs, along with four other soldiers, is accused of killing Afghan civilians for sport. Gibbs has also been accused of threatening fellow soldiers to remain quiet and cover up the crimes. A judge will determine whether there is enough evidence for the case to proceed to a full court-martial. The decision is expected to take several weeks.
Newly surfaced audio files of a cell phone conversation between Afghan Cabinet Minister Ismail Khan and an election official have stirred further controversy surrounding the September 18th Afghan parliamentary elections. The audio files appear to feature Khan instructing the election official to alter the announced list of winning candidates in Herat province. The Afghan Election Commission has launched investigations into these allegations of fraud. It is also investigating more than 6,000 formal complaints it has received since the election.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Mike Mullen have suggested that American forces will stay in Afghanistan until 2014. After 2014, the U.S. and international forces hope to turn control of security over to the Afghan police and army. President Obama previously set a July 2011 deadline for troops to begin withdrawal. The Taliban had interpreted that deadline as an end to American involvement and used it for propaganda.
Close to 60 major private security companies operating in combat zones have signed the International Code of Conduct, an agreement to respect human rights and rule of law. The code is the first of its kind to establish international standards for security companies. The code was signed by security contractors accused of numerous crimes against humanity in the past, including U.S.-based DynCorp International and Z Services, formerly known as Blackwater Worldwide. If companies violate the code, they will be punished with a breach of their commercial contracts. In addition, they will be flagged as a warning to potential clients.
This is War News Radio. It's easy to talk about war in terms of numbers, casualties, years of conflict, or money spent. But art expresses what numbers cannot. Amandine Lee recently went to the Windows and Mirrors exhibit in Philadelphia and spoke to artists and visitors.
Had you walked into the Art Street Meeting House in Philadelphia in October,
You wouldn't have found just a Quaker religious center, but painting upon painting hanging from the walls. The traveling exhibit, called Windows and Mirrors, consists of 45 4x6-foot brightly colored mural panels. Most are painted with thick black lines outlining motifs of warfare, suffering, and violence. Three marionettes with pained expressions, the outline of a body on the ground missing a leg and an arm, an Afghan girl caught in the crosshairs of a rifle. A few have softer themes, of a kite flying above the Afghan countryside, or a butterfly emerging from the word salam, meaning peace in Arabic. Then there are drawings created and captioned by high school students in Kabul, showing what life is like for them during wartime. One shows a pigeon shot by crossfire. Another is of a young amputee with the text, "A boy's body is information about the war." Charles Kelly, a real estate salesman who came to see the exhibit, found the children's pictures among the most poignant.
I see the children calling out, "Help, help," in their, actually the little words attached to some of their drawings. And my feeling is, in front of this one, that I get some of the agony of a person hit by one of the United States bombs. And it's so easy to forget that that people are dying agonizing deaths with our tax money. Like, you know, it makes me partially responsible, I think.
The war in Afghanistan entered its 10th year in October, but was hardly mentioned in the recent U.S. midterm elections. The American Friends Service Committee, or AFSC, conceived of Windows and Mirrors to bring awareness to, and, if possible, urge for the end of the war. The exhibit travels around the country, spending a month in each location. Karen Light, artist, teacher, and AFSC staff member, describes how the concept came about.
This came from the Chicago office, where we were talking about how to create something, and we wanted it to be artwork because we feel like it has a capacity to really touch people emotionally. And we wanted to come up with something that it wasn't so overwhelming that people felt like they couldn't act, like they got gripped by that, but also touching enough that people felt compelled to do something.
AFSC sent out a call to artists, and their prompt was simple: respond to civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The entries they received were numerous and varied.
We feel like we've gotten the range of emotion that anybody feels about war as a result. We've got suffering, we've got the pain, we've got the terror, you know, but we've also got the courage, we've got the information, we've got hope.
The artists themselves had a variety of motivations for participating in the show. Contributor Ann Northrup was motivated by the art form itself.
I've been working on these murals for 10 years, and the whole idea of a mural is, you know, a big public artwork has so much power beyond what I can wield in my little studio, you know, and my own little mind. And I just love the idea of a real public message that needs to be told. And so this project, with its theme of ending the war in Afghanistan, and with the backing of the American Friends Service Committee National Organization, has the power to really magnify my message.
Artist Deborah Gross-Zuckerman had a personal connection.
I was excited by this proposal because several years ago, our son Alex joined the Marines, and I had been doing many pieces against the war since then. It was hard for Philip and I to understand how our son, who had been taken to peace marches all his life, and son of two artists, could ever join the Marines. But it was something that he had to do, and as a result, it was something that I had to do by being creative in my artwork to express my feelings.
Joe Brenman, another contributor, was inspired by his desire to connect to the war.
That's something that is missing, you know, from many of our experiences. Very few Americans, I think, really know and have any real connection to that war. And yet, we're paying for it. And it's us that are supporting it.
Ultimately, the American Friends Service Committee is a pacifist Quaker organization, as Karen Light explains.
We also hope that people will just be compelled to pay more attention, to call their senators, to call their congresspeople, to bring up what they've learned to their family and friends. It could be as simple as that. But as somebody earlier mentioned, you know, it was really sad that in this election season, the war was hardly mentioned. And so we need it to be there. We need it to be something that people are talking about.
After Philadelphia, Windows and Mirrors moves on to New York, then Santa Monica and Chicago. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. Flooding from monsoon waters devastated Pakistan over the summer, but after the waters receded, the power struggle was just beginning. Aaron Moser checks in on the political fallout from the disaster.
The July floods directly affected over 20 million people, causing more than 1,750 deaths and forcing over 8 million Pakistanis to leave their homes, according to estimates in a U.S. congressional report. Military experts are concerned with the political implications. International security analyst Dr. Paul Buchanan believes that the fallout from the floods presents an opportunity to the Taliban.
Well, I think that the floods have definitely helped the Taliban recruit. And so in that measure, we should see some resurgence of their activities, not only in their strongholds, but in new areas that were affected by the flood.
Climatologists believe that as global climate change accelerates, the number of extreme weather events will follow. Dr. Heidi Cullen comments.
Those extreme events basically become more and more likely as you increase the level of CO2 in the atmosphere just because of the straight physics.
However, Cullen explains that extreme weather events are not directly caused by global climate change. Climate change only increases the probability that these events will occur.
So you can kind of think of it as an extreme weather autopsy. And what scientists do after an event is they try to kind of go back and look at the large-scale dynamics of the climate system and then try to understand the extent to which global warming may have increased the likelihood of that specific extreme event happening.
Cullen cites the 2010 floods in Pakistan as an individual weather event influenced by greater climate forces.
The way that global warming potentially comes into the story is the fact that the Indian Ocean surface temperatures were very, very warm this summer. They were upwards of 1.5 to 2 degrees warmer than average. Now, we know that when you have warmer ocean temperatures, it provides more fuel, more moisture for these storms. And so you can begin to look at, okay, to what extent is global warming increasing sea surface temperatures? We know that it's playing a role in ocean warming, you know, and maybe that is one way that, you know, something like global warming could have influenced the intensity and the unusualness of this specific monsoon.
Dr. Gerald Mayerly from the Center for Naval Analysis, a federally funded research and development center, sees the security impacts of the floods as far-reaching. In the short term, the Pakistani military and NATO forces have had to concentrate their efforts on relief work instead of patrolling the Afghan-Pakistan border.
One of the first things the Pakistani military said was, you know, given these floods, given the pressures on us to provide relief, you know, we're going to have to pull back from some of these operations that we've been doing up in these more remote border areas in order to provide relief to, you know, Pakistanis in some of the more intensely flood, you know, hit areas and the more densely populated areas of the country along the major rivers. So, yeah, the Pakistani military that's doing most of these operations has pulled back from some of these areas, and that's allowed these groups to come back. So in the short term, yeah, it's a big problem for Pakistan. It's a bigger problem for the United States because it's mainly the United States that's pushing for a lot of these operations up near the border. So in the short term, it's a serious problem, and it affects U.S. operations on the other side in Afghanistan because that allows the insurgents to step up their tempo of operations against U.S. and NATO forces.
These impacts, though, are not what makes Merrily most worried. He believes that the devastating wake of the floods will create a power vacuum, which the Taliban will use to their advantage.
The big one is that the floods have destroyed a lot of the government infrastructure and undermine a lot of the government's authority in a lot of these areas, especially in the border areas where the insurgency is strongest. So whenever you have the government being weakened like that, the insurgents are going to come in and fill a lot of the void. And that's obviously going to have pretty big security implications in Pakistan, but also in Afghanistan, because a lot of the insurgents that are fighting in Afghanistan are actually based in Pakistan and camps in Pakistan.
Buchanan agrees with Mayor Lee's assessment of the situation and also believes the floods will allow the Taliban to gain legitimacy in the region.
In the chaos of the floods, the one actor that could operate as a military entity was the Taliban, and more importantly, the Taliban in some of the affected regions were able to provide a measure of basic services that the state should have provided. So they become the de facto sovereigns at a time of abject need, and that raises their legitimacy in the eyes of the victimized population.
However, Pakistani journalist and editor-in-chief of Blue Chip magazine, Humayun Gohar, does not expect the Taliban to grow as a result of the floods, despite governmental incompetence. He believes that opinions like those of Mayor Lee and Buchanan are too simplistic.
They were more interested in going back to their homes, rebuilding their houses, getting their lives restarted again, getting their fields going, getting the canals going. This is what they know. People just don't just like that go and join the Taliban like that. That's a specific group, specific ethnic groups, and specific religious sects or schools of thought or movements, if you like.
But Mayor Lee thinks that the Taliban can help people resettle and put their lives together. He explains that in many areas, the natural walls that divide property have been destroyed, and that since the government is unable to adjudicate these disputes, the Taliban will try and assert its authority.
So a lot of the natural barriers that kind of delineate people's lands have been washed away. So now no one knows who owns what in a lot of these areas. And the government is so corrupt and ineffective at the local level, people often don't have deeds to their own land on paper, and it's not held in any computers. And so you're already having all these land disputes. You know, have large landowners grabbing the land from small farmers. You have small farmers, because their walls have been washed away, are unable to prove where their land really is. The government is unable to help. And then you get these kind of roaming judges that come in, you know, these kind of mullahs with some little religious education, and they come into these areas and they adjudicate these disputes very quickly. They get the landowners together and they listen to their pleas and they make decisions. And the government just is unable to do that. People go through the courts and they'll go for 3 or 4 years and no decision will ever be made. But the insurgents, the Taliban, could come into these areas and make decisions very quickly.
Despite Mayor Lee's account, Gohar denies that this is taking place. He asserts that local government has control.
No. I think that's obviously somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about, because the property is demarcated on, maps and so on. By the way, these maps are made on huge bolts of cotton cloth. And there is an officer which is called a patwari who knows exactly which piece of land, how big, belongs to whom. So, I mean, the walls may have broken down physically, but, you know, on the maps, we know exactly whose property is which. So that's nonsense. That can't happen.
Gohar does criticize the government's response to the floods, but he trusts that other actors will step in, preventing the Taliban from gaining popularity.
Yes, the state failed in providing these people with things, but, you know, we have a very strong private social sector, and also a lot of them come from abroad.
Although domestic charities and foreign governments have been huge sources of aid in the past, Mayor Lee states that the U.S. and Pakistani militaries must be better prepared to deal with natural disasters in the future.
And even us, even our own military, I mean, yeah, we're fighting a war in Afghanistan, we think that's important. You know, we're pushing the Pakistanis to fight a war on their side of the border, but responding adequately to this flood or to that earthquake that happened in 2005 is probably almost as important for our interests in that region as fighting these insurgencies.
Looking forward to the rest of the 21st century, it is clear that there is a new threat to U.S. national security. This threat is no hostile government nor rebel group, but rather an atmosphere of our own making. For War News Radio, along with Kyle Crawford, I'm Aaron Moser.
This is War News Radio. Many aspects of life in Afghanistan, including education, healthcare, and employment, have deteriorated in the past 3 decades of fighting. Afghanistan relies on the efforts of local and international NGOs for help. Marina Tuktuk brings us more on the Afghan School Project, an international volunteer organization that focuses on education, particularly for women and children. This piece first aired in July.
The educational system in Afghanistan has witnessed a sharp decline that began with the Soviet invasion in 1979 and worsened under the Taliban's rule. According to the UN, schools, teachers, and students are frequently targeted by insurgents. Unfortunately, social barriers also prevent most girls from going to school. Now, the Ministry of Education estimates that 70% of Afghans are illiterate. Although the 2001 U.S. invasion has slightly improved education in the country, challenges still persist, especially for girls. Muhammad Asif Nang, the General Director of Publication and Information at the Ministry of Education of Afghanistan, explains.
We're receiving only 15% of national budget to the section of education. It's necessary to increase the budget for the education till 30%. And then of 13,000 of schools, only 50% of them have a building. Then most of cities in most of provinces, they don't have electricity. Lack of security has caused don't come children to the school, especially girls. And about 200 districts, we haven't a single woman teacher among the 450 districts in overall Afghanistan. Also, that is the challenge.
Some international and local NGOs have tried to make up the difference by giving girls the opportunity to study. One such organization is the Afghan School Project, an international volunteer initiative based in Canada that works with educators at the ACCC, the Afghan-Canadian Community Center in Kandahar. The center provides classes to women to give them marketable skills. Ryan Aldard, the director of the Afghan School Project, talks about how the project's idea started.
Basically, the Afghan School Project was started in late 2006. Myself and my fiancé, Andrea Caverly, read a newspaper article about Ehsan Al-Ehsan, an educator in Kandahar. We heard about the good work that he was doing, but we also heard about some of the challenges that he was facing. And we were really, I'm not sure what it was about that story, but we were really touched by what Ehsan was doing, and we really wanted to make a difference and help him in any way that we could.
Aldred didn't know the extent to which he wanted to contribute to the ACCC.
Originally, we were thinking, oh, we'll help Ehsan buy a computer or pay a teacher's salary for a few months. But when we started speaking to Ehsan, we just realized that there was more that we could do and there was more that we wanted to do. So we started the Afghan School Project. And we sent over enough money to Kandahar to help Ehsan establish the Afghan-Canadian Community Center. We started with about 100 students who were in residential Kandahar in a small house that we had converted into a school. And it really just took off. We were just amazed by how successful it was in a very short period of time.
The Afghan School Project helps fund and monitor the ACCC's operation and connects it with resources from Canada. Aldered again.
The concept behind what we do is acting as advisor to the school. The Afghan-Canadian Community Center is entirely Afghan-run and operated, and we help fill the gaps. And so we'll help develop partnerships with Canadian and U.S. Educational institutions to help with curriculum development or offering online classes. We'll help write grant proposals. We'll raise funds. We just work with wherever the need is.
Now, the ACCC stands with 1,500 students, 40 staff, and about 30 to 40 volunteers. The center has recently celebrated its spring graduation.
A huge number of girls got very good jobs with different organizations after taking these courses, so they have a really good impact on Afghan women, especially in Kandahar. These courses allow them to be a very useful part of the community to develop the country.
That was Shamim Bibi, one of the student graduates who started taking online management courses at the ACCC in 2007. Many Afghan girls are willing to go to school, but social and security concerns stand in their way. Girls are often intimidated.
More
Most of the girls are now scared to go to school. One time, I remember, someone threw oil on a girl's face. So after that, many girls left school.
Aldert says that the center has dealt with the security concerns that girls have by ensuring a safe transportation network.
Not that many students have access to a vehicle or have access to transportation. So having this transportation really helps reach a much broader range of students. And it also helps them feel much safer in terms of coming to school. They're not necessarily subject to the same kind of intimidation.
In light of the many difficulties facing the country's economy, the center tries to guarantee the right of education for women in Afghanistan. Even though the ACCC is focused on professional education, it still tries to reach out to more girls.
We work with a really diverse range. The focus of the Afghan Canadian Community Center is professional education. And so we work with really anyone who's interested in learning job skills. Mm-hmm. We have some young women who are as young as 11 or 12 who are just starting to learn basic English. And we have women who are in their late 30s or mid 40s who did not have the opportunity to receive education during the Taliban regime. And so we just work with wherever the need is.
Aldred is satisfied with the progress of the project. Although based in Canada, he frequently talks to students.
I quite regularly have the chance to speak with students and talk to them and see how they're doing. For so many of them, their parents they can't read, they work as laborers, they work backbreaking hours. And by and large, they all have the same sort of feeling, and that is really a feeling of gratitude. They're just so grateful to have this opportunity.
In Bibi's own words, she also appreciates the opportunity she was given to study and work.
I'm really pleased to have these courses because before I did not have experience with management. But after, I learned how to manage projects and be helpful within any organization. I also gained experience in accounting management, human resource issues, and business communication.
Bibi suggests that in order to support the improvement of education and encourage children to go to school, it is imperative to provide education to their parents.
I would like to say that looking at the current economic situation in Afghanistan, I think there should be a different kind of education project for children as well as projects implemented for their families. Parents will then recognize that education is a basic need of the community, so they will change their minds and send their children to the school.
Although Bibi has come a long way in her education, she still aspires to continue studying.
I want to get higher education, but there is no opportunity for me to get my education. For this to happen, some courses should be established in the future so we would be able to continue our study.
Many Afghan girls have the ambition to improve their skills and acquire advanced education. They dream of having careers and contributing to the building of their nation. However, the difficulties currently facing Afghanistan's educational system are too great for this to be easy anytime soon. The journey to improve education in Afghanistan will be a long one. For War News Radio, I'm Marina Tuktuk.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anjali Kadambi, Emily Crawford, Sam Hirschman, Louis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Jonathan Kwan, Viola Tuvnikas, Christina Pham, Kareem Sariamet, and Marina Tuktuk. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Eliana Biscard-Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.